Blog Talk Radio. Quincy lived to be 74 years old, and he was at his height of fame, and you know, he was a man of letters and a philosopher and so on, but his entire work was inspired by opium and body of work. And of course his mind was, you know, a brilliant man. But I'm going to read the first, because I think I got through the first paragraph last week of this, but it's worth repeating it only because it begins the whole section that I'll be reading tonight, and it's called The Pleasures of Opium, which is one full segment of the Confessions of an English Opium Eater. And we'll begin. It is so long since I first took opium that if it had been a trifling incident in my life, I might have forgotten its date. But cardinal events are not to be forgotten. And from circumstances connected with it, I remember that it must be referred to the autumn of 1804. During the season, I was in London, having some thither for the first time since my entrance at college. And my introduction to opium arose the following way. From an early age, I had been accustomed to wash my face in cold water at least once a day, being suddenly seized with toothache. I attributed to some relaxation caused by an accidental intermission of that practice, jumped out of bed, plunged my head into a basin of cold water, and with hair thus wetted, went to sleep. The next morning, as I need hardly say, I woke with an excruciating rheumatic pains of the head and face, from which I had hardly any respite for about 20 days. And on the 21st day, I think it was, and on a Sunday, that I went out into the streets rather than to run away, if possible, from my torments, than with any distinct purpose. By accident, I met a college acquaintance who recommended opium. Opium? Dread agent of unimaginable pleasure and pain? I had heard of it, as I had of mania and of manna, rather, or of ambrosia, but no further. How unmeaning sound was it at that time? That solemn chord doesn't now strike upon my heart. What heart-quaking vibrations of sad and happy remembrances. Reverting for a moment to these, I feel a mystic importance attached to the minutest circumstances connected with the place and the time and the man, if man he was, that first laid open to me the paradise of opium eaters. It was a Sunday afternoon, wet and cheerless, and a duller spectacle this earth of ours has not to show than a rainy Sunday in London. My road homeward lay through Oxford Street and near the stately Pantheon, as Mr. Wordsworth had obligingly called it. I saw a druggist's shop. The druggist, unconscious minister of celestial pleasures, as if in sympathy with a rainy Sunday, looked dull and stupid, just as any mortal druggist might be expected to look on a Sunday. And when I asked for the tincture of opium, he gave it to me, as any other man might do. And furthermore, out of my shilling, returned me what seemed to be real copper halfpence, taken out of a real wooden drawer. Nevertheless, in spite of such indications of humanity, he has ever since existed in my mind as the beatific vision of an immortal druggist, sent down to earth on a special mission to myself. And it confirms me in this way of considering him, that when I next came up to London, I sought him near the stately Pantheon and found him not. And thus to me, who knew not his name, if indeed he had one? And he seemed rather to have vanished from Oxford Street than to have removed in any bodily fashion. The reader may choose to think him as possibly no more than a sublunary druggist. It may be so, but my faith is better. I believe him to effervesced, rather, or evaporated. So unwillingly would I connect my mortal remembrances with that hour and place and creature that first brought me acquainted with the celestial drug. Arrived at my lodging, it may be supposed that I lost not a moment of taking the quantity prescribed. I was necessarily ignorant of the whole art and mystery of opium taking, and what I took under every disadvantage. But I took it, and in an hour, oh heavens, what a revulsion. What an upheaving from its lowest depths of inner spirit. What an apocalypse of the world within me. That my pains had vanished was now a trifle in my eyes. This negative effect was swallowed up in the immensity of those positive effects which had opened before me, in the abyss of divine enjoyment thus suddenly revealed. Here was a panacea for all human woes. Here was the secret of happiness about which philosophers had disputed for so many ages. At once discovered happiness might now be bought for a penny and carried in the waistcoat pocket. Portable ecstasies might be had corked up in a pipe bottle, and peace of mind could be sent down in gallons by the mail coach. But if I talk in this way, the reader will think I am laughing, and I can assure him that nobody will laugh long who deals much with opium. Its pleasures even are of a grave and solemn complexion, and in his happiest state the opium eater cannot present himself in the character of l'allegro. Even then he speaks and thinks as becomes il pensiero. Nevertheless, I have a very reprehensible way of jesting at times in the midst of my own misery, and unless when I am checked by some more powerful feelings, I am afraid I shall be guilty of this indecent practice, even in these annals of suffering or enjoyment. The reader must allow a little to my infirm nature in this respect. With a few indulgences of that sort, I shall endeavor to be as grave, if not drowsy, as fits a theme like opium, so anti-mercurial as it really is, and so drowsy as it is falsely reputed. The first one word, and first, one word with respect to its bodily effects. For upon all that has been hitherto written on the subject of opium, whether by travelers in Turkey who may plead the privilege of lying as an old immemorial right, or by professors of medicine writing ex cathedra, I have but one emphatic criticism to pronounce. Lies, lies, lies. I remember once in passing a bookstall to have caught these words from a page of some satiric author. By this time, he quotes, by this time I became convinced that the London newspaper spoke truth at least twice a week, viz. On Tuesday and Saturday, and might safely be depended upon for the last of bankrupts, or the list of bankrupts. In like manner, I do by no means deny that some truths have been delivered to the world in regard to opium. Thus it has been reputed, affirmed by the learned, that opium is a dusty brown in color, and this, take notice, I grant. Secondly, that it is rather clear, and also I grant, for in my time, East Indian opium has been 3 guineas a pound, and Turkey 8. And thirdly, that if you eat a good deal of it, most probably you must do what is particularly disagreeable to any man of regular habits, die. These weighty propositions are all the singular true. I cannot gainsay them, and truth ever was and will be commendable. But in these three theorems, I believe we have exhausted the stock of knowledge as yet accumulated by man on the subject of opium. And therefore, worthy doctors, as there seems to be room for further discoveries, stand aside and allow me to come forward and lecture on this matter. First, then, it is not so much affirmed as taken for granted by all who ever mentioned opium formally or incidentally that it does or can produce intoxication. Now, reader, assure yourself that no quantity of opium ever did or could intoxicate. As to the tincture of opium, commonly called laudanum, that might certainly intoxicate if a man could bear to take enough of it. But why? Because it contains so much proof spirit, and not because it contains so much opium, but crude opium, I affirm peremptorily, is incapable of producing any state of body at all resembling that which is produced by alcohol, and not in degree only incapable, but even in kind. It is not in the quantity of its effects merely, but in the quality that it differs altogether. The pleasure given by wine is always mounting and tending to a crisis, after which it declines. That from opium, when once generated, is stationary for 8 or 10 hours. First, to borrow a technical distinction from medicine, is a case of acute. The second, the chronic pleasure. The one is a flame, the other a steady and equitable glow. But the main distinction lies in this, that whereas wine disorders the mental faculties, opium, on the contrary, if taken in a proper manner, introduces amongst them the most exquisite order, legislation, and harmony. Wine robs a man of his self-possession. Opium greatly invigorates it. Wine unsettles and clouds the judgment and gives a preternatural brightness and a vivid exaltation to the contempts and the admirations, the loves and hatreds of the drinker. Opium, on the contrary, communicates serenity and equipoise to all the faculties, active or passive, and with respect to the temper and moral feelings in general, it gives simply that sort of vital warmth which is approved by the judgment and which would probably always accompany a bodily constitution of primeval and antediluvian health. Thus, for instance, opium, like wine, gives an expansion to the heart and the benevolent affections by them, with this remarkable difference, that in the sudden development of heart of kind-heartedness which accompanies inebriation, there is always more or less of a maudlin character which exposes it to the contempt of the bystander. Men shake hands, swear eternal friendship, and shed tears. No mortal knows why, and a sensual creature is clearly uppermost. But the expansion of the benigner feeling incident to opium is no febrile access, but a healthy restoration to that state which the mind would naturally recover upon the removal of any deep-seated irritation or pain that had disturbed and quarreled with the impulses of a heart originally just and good. True it is that even wine, up to a certain point, with certain men, rather, tends to exalt and steady the intellect. I myself, who have never been a great wine drinker, used to find that half a dozen glasses of wine advantageously affected the faculties, brightened and intensified the consciousness, and gave the mind a feeling of being drunk. And certainly, it is most absurdly said, in popular language, of any man that he is disguised in liquor, or for the contrary, most men are disguised by sobriety. I like that. And it is when they are drinking, as some old gentlemen say in Athenius, that men display themselves in their true complexion of character, which surely is not disguising themselves. But still, wine constantly leads a man to the brink of absurdity and extravagance, and beyond. beyond a certain point, it is sure to volatilize and to disperse the intellectual energies, whereas opium always seems to compose what has been agitated and to concentrate what had been disturbed. In short, to sum up all in one word, a man who is inebriated or attending to inebriation is and feels that he is in a condition which calls up into supremacy the merely human. Too often the brutal part of his nature, but the opium eater, I speak of him who is not suffering from any disease or other remote effects of opium, feels that the divine parts of his nature is paramount. That is, the moral affections are in a state of cloudless serenity, and over all is the great light of the majestic intellect. This is the doctrine of the true church on the subject of opium, of which church I acknowledge myself to be the only member, the Alpha and the Omega. But then it is to be recollected that I speak from the ground of a large and profound personal experience, whereas most of the unscientific authors who have at all treated of their opium, and even of those who have written expressly on the materia medica, make it evident from the horror they express of it that their experimental knowledge of its action is not at all. I will, however, candidly acknowledge that I have met with one person who bore evidence to its intoxicating power, such as staggered my own incredulity, for he was a surgeon and had himself taken opium largely. I happened to say to him that his enemies, as I had heard, charged him with taking nonsense on politics, talking nonsense on politics, and that his friends apologized for him but suggested that he was constantly in a state of intoxication from opium. Now the accusation, said I, is not prima facie and of necessity, an absurd one, but the defense is. To my surprise, however, he insisted that both his enemies and his friends were in the right. I will maintain, said he, that I do not talk nonsense. And secondly, I will maintain that I do not talk nonsense upon principle or with any view or to profit, but solely and simply, he said, solely and simply, repeating it three times over, because I am drunk with opium, and that daily. This is what he said. I replied that as to the allegation of his enemies, as it seemed to be established upon such respectable testimony, seeing that the three parties concerned all agree in it, it did not become me to question it. But the defense set up, I must demur to. He proceeded to discuss the matter and to lay down his reasons, but it seemed to me so impolite, so to pursue an argument which must have mentioned that a man who talks nonsense, even though with no view to profit, is not altogether the most agreeable partner in a dispute, whether as opponent or respondent. I confess, however, that the authority of a surgeon, and one who is reputed a good one, may seem a weighty one to be to my prejudice. But still, I must plead my experience, which was greater than his greatest by 7,000 drops a day. And though it was not possible to suppose a medical man unacquainted with the characteristic symptoms of venous intoxication, it yet struck me that he might proceed on a logical error of using the word intoxication with too great latitude and extending it generically to all modes of nervous excitement, instead of restricting it as the expression for a specific sort of excitement connected with certain diagnostics. Some people have maintained in many hearings that they have been drunk upon green tea, and a medical student in London, for whose knowledge in his profession I have reason to feel great respect, assured me that said the other day that a patient in recovering from an illness had got drunk on a beefsteak. Having dwelt so much on this first and leading era in respect to opium, I shall notice very briefly a second and third, which are that the elevation of spirits produced by opium is necessarily followed by a proportionate depression, and that the natural and even immediate consequence of opium is torpor and stagnation, animal and mental. The first of these errors I shall content myself with, simply denying and assuring my reader that for 10 years, during which I took opium at intervals, the day succeeding to it, on which I allowed myself this luxury, was always a day of unusually good spirits. So he's saying that he never really got too depressed while he was taking. Back to the torpor supposed to follow, or rather, if we were to credit the numerous pictures of Turkish opium eaters who accompany the practice of opium eating, I deny that also. Certainly, opium is classified, or rather, is classed under the head of narcotics, and some such effect, if may, produced in the end, but the primary effect of opium are always, and in the highest degree, to excite, stimulate the system. The first stage of its action always lasted with me during my novitiate for upwards of 8 hours, so that it must be the fault of the opium eater himself if he does not so time his exhibition of the dose, to speak medically, as that the whole weight of its narcotic influence may descend upon his sleep. Turkish opium eaters, it seems, are absurd enough to sit, like so many equestrian statues, on logs of wood as stupid as themselves. But that the reader may judge of the degree in which opium is likely to stupefy the faculties of an Englishman, I say, by way of treating the question illustratively rather than argumentatively, describe the way in which I myself often passed an opium evening in London during a period between 1804 and 1812. It will be seen that at least opium did not move me to seek solitude, and much less to seek inactivity or the torpid state of self-involution described to the Turks. I give this account of the risk of being pronounced a crazy enthusiast or visionary, but I regard that little. I must desire my reader to bear in mind that I was a hard student and had severe studies for all the rest of my time, and certainly I had a right occasionally to relaxations as well as other people, and these, however, I allowed myself but seldom. The late Duke of Blank used to say, "Next Friday, by the blessings of heaven, I propose to be drunk," and in like manner, I used to fix beforehand how often within a given time and when I would commit a debauch of opium. This was seldom more than once in 3 weeks, for at that time I would have ventured to call every day, as I did afterwards for a glass of laudanum negus, warm and without sugar. No, as I have said, I seldom drank laudanum at that time, more than once in 3 weeks. This was usually on a Tuesday or a Saturday night. My reason for which was this. In those days, Grassini sang at the opera, and her voice was delightful to me, beyond all that I had ever heard. And I know not what may be the state of the opera house now, having never been within its walls for 7 or 8 years, but at that time it was by much the most pleasant piece of public resort in London for passing an evening. 5 shillings admitted one to the gallery, which was subject to far less annoyance than the pit of the theaters, and the orchestra was distinguished by it grandeur from all English orchestras, and the composition of which, I confess, is not acceptable to my ear. From the prominence, or rather the predominance, of the clamorous instruments and the absolute tyranny of the violin, the choruses were divine to hear, and when Grassini appeared in some interlude, as she often did, and poured forth her passionate soul as Andromache or the at the tomb of Hector, I question whether any Turk of all that ever entered the paradise of opium eaters can have had half the pleasure I had. But indeed, I honor the barbarians who too much by supposing them capable of any pleasures approaching to the intellectual ones of an Englishman. For music is an intellectual or sensual pleasure, according to the temperament of him who hears it. And by, with the exception of a fine extravaganza on that subject in Twelfth Night, I do not recollect more than one thing said adequately on the subject of music in all literature. It is a passage on the Religio Medici, or of Sir T. Brown, and though chiefly remarkable for its sublimity, has also a philosophic value, inasmuch as it points to the true theory of musical effects, and the but this is not so. It is by the reaction of the mind upon the notices of the ear, the matter coming by the senses and the form from the mind, that the pleasure is constructed, and therefore it is that people of equally good ear differ so much in this point from one another. Now opium, by greatly increasing the activity of the mind, generally increases of necessity that peculiar mode of its activity by which we are able to construct out of the raw material of organic sound an elaborate intellectual pleasure. But, say a friend, a succession of musical sounds is to me like a collection of Arabic letters or characters. I can attach no ideas to them. Ideas, my good sir, there is no occasion for them. All that class of ideas which can be available in such a case has a language of representative feelings. But this is a subject foreign to my present purposes. It is sufficient to say that a chorus of elaborate harmony displayed before me, as in the piece of Ara's work, the whole of my past life, not as it recalled by an act of memory, but as if presented and incarnated in the music, not no longer painful to dwell upon, but the details of its incidents removed or blended in some hazy abstraction, and its passions exalted, spiritualized, and sublimed. All this was to be had for 5 shillings. Over and above the music of the stage and orchestra, I had all around me, in the intervals of the performance, the music of the Italian language, talked by Italian women, for the gallery was usually crowded with Italians, and I listened with a pleasure such as that with which Weld, the traveler, lay and listened in Canada, the sweet laughter of Indian women. For the less you understand of a language, the more sensible you are to the melody or harshness of its sounds. For such a purpose, therefore, it was an advantage to me that I was a poor Italian scholar, reading it but little, and not speaking it at all, nor understanding a tenth part of what I heard spoken. And I find this fascinating, you know, that because if anybody's ever been stoned and sitting in with a bunch of people who speak different languages, it's an overwhelming experience. And probably the only way to get through a night where everybody's speaking a different language except you, you know, except your own. And, there are 2 things I wanted to mention here and bring about, and I sense that you must have observed it. satire or just because of his you know, speaking to his audience, you know, knowing his audience is the possibly London elite, you know. But you know, comparing himself to, you know, to that, to the elite, you know, as opposed to the barbarian consuming opium, you know. And this was so prevalent because it was the elite that smoked opium or ate opium, if you will. But, I mean, it was everybody, you know, and it's no different today with pot smokers or cocaine heads or, you know, addicts or whatever. To me, what always affected me when I read this was similar to the effects of pot. Personally, I'm an advocate. You know, there's no question. I don't disguise it. But the fact is that, you know, there with the difference between pot and, say, opium is that there are, opium is as addictive as hell, where pot is not. You know, you get great pleasure with pot, but no addiction. All right, no addiction to it. Maybe a psychological a crutch, if you will, at times. But you can break away from it. It's not like cigarettes or like opium, where you crave it. You crave it. You know, you don't. You can function quite normally. But if you, I mean, it's interesting that Mark Phelps and Usain Bolt, both the fastest man in the world. Two fastest men in the water and the land in the world, and multiple gold medal winners, both use pot, you know, marijuana, all right, to relax and to enjoy themselves, and they openly use it. So it's like, you know, man has always needed these things, and you know, to engage his mind and to relax and to expand upon the thoughts and expand upon things. And all men, I don't care who they are, you know, need some thing. Either they drink or they smoke or they have sex or they do something. You know, women as well, you know. But in De Quincey's day, it was opium was the key. And, you know, and of course, his opium addiction caused him great pain later on, his nightmares and his physical problems that he developed. Whereas the, you know, nobody I know of smokes pot has ever come down with an affliction. You know, if anything, it's helped them out tremendously as a medicine. So, that's just my aside, my comparison. But let me continue. With this. Thus I have shown that opium does not of necessity produce inactivity or torpor, but that, on the contrary, if it often led me to markets and theaters. Yet in candor, I will admit the markets and theaters are not the appropriate haunts of opium eaters when in the devised state incident to his enjoyment. In that state, crowds become an oppression to him, music even too sensual and gross. He naturally seeks solitude and silence as indispensable conditions of those trances or profoundest reveries, which are the crown and consummation of what opium can do for human nature. I, whose disease it was to meditate too much and to observe too little, and who upon which was the crown and consummation, who upon my first entrance at college was nearly falling into a deep melancholy from brooding too much on the sufferings which I had witnessed in London, was sufficiently aware of the tendencies of my own thoughts to do all I could to counteract them. I was indeed like a person who, according to the old legend, had entered the cave of Trophonius, and the remedies I sought were to force myself into society, and to keep my understanding and continual activity upon matters of science. But for these remedies, I should certainly have become hypochondriacally melancholy. And after years, however, when my cheerfulness was more fully reestablished, I yielded to my natural inclination for a solitary life. And at that time, I often fell into these reveries upon taking opium, and more than once it was happened to me on a summer night when I had been at an open window in a room from which I could overlook the sea at a mile below me and could command a view of the great towns of L, at which about the same distance that I have sat from sunset to sunset, motionless and without wishing to move. I shall be charged with mysticism, demonism, quietism, but that shall not harm me. Sir H. Vane, the younger, was one of our wisest men, and let my reader see if he, in his philosophical works, be half as unmystical as I am. I say, then, that it has often struck me that the scene itself was somewhat typical of what took place in such a reverie. The town of El represented the earth, that its sorrows and its graves left behind, yet not out of sight, not wholly forgotten. The ocean is everlasting but gentle agitation, and brooded over by a dove-like calm, might not unfitly typify the mind and the mood which they swayed. For it seemed to me that if they first I stood at a distance and aloof from the uproar of life, as if the tumult, the fever, and the strife were suspended, a respite granted from the secret burdens of the heart, a Sabbath of repose, a resting from human labors. Here were the hopes which blossom in the paths of life and reconciled in the peace which is in the grave. Motions of the intellect are unwearied as the heavens, yet for all anxieties a helison, calm, a tranquility that seemed no product of inertia, but as if resulting from mighty and equal antagonisms, infinite activities, and infinite repose. O just, subtle, and mighty opium, that to the hearts of poor and rich alike, for the wounds that will never heal and for the pains that tempt the spirit to rebel, bringest an assuaging balm, eloquent opium, that with thy potent rhetoric stealest away the purposes of wrath, and to the guilty man for one night givest back the hopes of his youth and hands washed pure from blood, and to the proud man a brief oblivion, for wrongs undressed and insults unavenged. That summon to the chancery of dreams, for the triumphs of suffering innocence, false witnesses, and confoundest perjury. And thus reverence, thus reverse the sentences of unrighteous judges. Thou buildest upon the bosom of darkness, out of the fantastic imagery of the brain, cities and temples beyond the art of Phidias and Praxiteles, beyond the splendor of Babylon and Hecatompolis, from the anarchy of dreaming sleep, calling into sunny light the faces of long buried beauties and the blessed household countenances cleansed from the dishonors of the grave. Thou only givest these gifts to man, and thou hast the keys of paradise, O just, subtle, and mighty opium. And you can see the inspiration that getting loaded on opium gave this man. Just as it does to so many people, you know. So many people. And it's threatening that we have to be loaded on something in order to rise to the level of spiritual or intellectual enlightenment, you know. It's just work. Because those people who aren't are people who don't get loaded, people who don't expand their minds in some way, right, are the dullest people I've ever met in my life. You ever sit with somebody who's never drank or had a cigarette or had a drink or smoked a joint or you know, got laid or you know, I mean, my God, I mean, what kind of freako person is that? You know, it's like you it's life. I mean, life. I can't spend 5 minutes with somebody like that, and I don't know anybody who can. So, you know, and if anybody preaches the fact that they are that way, you know, you don't believe them. They're probably schizophrenic. The other half of them moves another way, you know. The other half is Charlie Harper and, you know, Charlie Sheen. And the other half is Saint Peter or something, you know. So you get, you're walking schizophrenic. Okay, if you don't indulge in something. And some people either eat themselves to death, other people drink themselves to death, other people smoke weed or smoke crack or smoke or you know, snort heroin or shoot it. It's terrible in so many ways, what happens to the addictions. But those people that control their addictions or control their, I got your control and addiction, but you know, people that use opiates or use narcotics or use pot or use some other form of enhancement, you know, or in itself, they get by that way. And they get through their lives that way. And, this gentleman, Thomas DeQuincy, lived to be 74 years old. Indulging his, himself, with opium. And, of course, he went through some serious problems as well, which we'll get into in the next few minutes. It's called The Introduction to the Pains of Opium. Courteous, and I hope indulgent reader, for all my readers must be indulgent ones, or else I fear I shall shock them too much to count on their courtesy. Having accompanied me thus far, now let me request you to move cowards for about 8 years. That is to say, from 1804, when I have said that my acquaintance with opium first began, to 1812. The years of academic life are now over and gone, almost forgotten. The student's cap no longer presses my temple. If my cap existed at all, it presses all those of some youthful scholar. I trust as happy as myself and as passionate a lover of knowledge. My gown is by this time, I dare say, in the same condition with many thousand excellent books in the Bodleian, diligently perused by certain studious moths and worms, or departed, however, which is all that I know of his fate, to that great reservoir of somewhere to which all the teacups, tea kettles, and caddies and teapots, tea kettles, etc., have departed. Not to speak of still frailer vessels, such as glasses, decanters, bedmakers, which occasional resemblances in the present generation of teacups remind me of having once possessed, but of whose departure and final fate I, in common with most gownsmen of either university, could give, I suspect, but an obscure and conjectural history. The persecutions of the chapel bell, sounding its unwelcome unwelcome summons to 6 o'clock matins and interrupts my slumber no longer. And the porter who rang it, upon those whose beautiful nose, bronze inlaid with copper, I wrote in retaliation to my Greek epigrams which I was dressing, is dead and has ceased to disturb anybody. And I and many others who suffered much from his tinnitus propensities have now agreed to overlook his errors and have forgiven him. Even with the bell, I am now in charity. It rings, I suppose, as formerly thrice a day and cruelly annoys, I doubt not, any worthy gentleman, and disturbs their peace of mind. But as to me, in this year of 1812, I regard its treacherous voice no longer. And treacherous I call it, for by some refinement of malice I spoke in as sweet and silvery tones as if it had been inviting one to a party. Its tones have no longer, indeed, power to reach me. Let the wind sit as favorable as the malice of the bell itself could wish, for I am 250 miles away from it, and buried in the depth of mountains. And what am I doing among the mountains? Taking opium. Yes, but what else? Why, reader, in 1812, the year we are now arrived at, as well as for some years previous, I have been chiefly studying German metaphysics in the writings of Kant, Fichte, Schelling, etc. And how and in what manner do I live? In short, what class of description of men do I belong to? I am at this period, in 1812, living in a cottage and with a single female servant, who, amongst my neighbors, passes by the name of my housekeeper. And as a scholar and a man of learned education, and in that sense a gentleman, I may presume to class myself as an unworthy member of the indefinite body called gentleman. Partly on the ground I have assigned, perhaps partly because from my having no visible calling or business, it is rightly judged that I must be living on my private fortune. I am so classed by my neighbors, and by the courtesy of modern England, I am usually addressed on letters, Esquire, though having, I fear, in rigorous concentration, construction of heralds, been slender pretensions to that distinguished honor, yet in popular estimation, I am XYZ, Esquire, but not just of the peace, nor custom rotulorum. Am I married? Not yet. And I still take opium? On Saturday nights, and perhaps have taken it unblushingly ever since the rainy Sunday, the stately Pantheon, the beatific druggist of 1804. Even so, and how do I find my health after all this opium eating? In short, how do I do? Why, pretty well, I thank you, reader, in the phrase of ladies in the straw, as well as can be expected. In fact, if I dared to say the real and simple truth, though to satisfy the theories of medical men, I ought to be ill. I never was better in my life than in the spring of 1812, and I hope sincerely that the quantity of claret, port, or particularly Madeira, which in all probability you, good reader, have taken and designed to take for every term of 8 years during your natural life, may as little disorder your health as mine was disordered by opium I had taken for 8 years between 1804 and 1812. Hence, you may see again the danger of taking any medical advice from Anastasius in divinity. For aught I know, or law, he may be a safe counselor, but not in medicine. No, it is far better to consult Dr. Buchan, as I did, for I never forgot that worthy man's excellent suggestion, and I was particularly careful not to take above 5 and 20 ounces of laudanum. To this moderation and temperate use of the article I may ascribe it, I suppose that as yet, at least, in 1812, I am ignorant and unsuspicious of the avenging terrors which opium has in store for those who abuse its lenity. By the same time, it must not be forgotten that hitherto I have been only a dilettante eater of opium. 8 years' practice, even, with a single precaution of allowing sufficient intervals between every indulgence, has not been sufficient to make opium necessary to me as an article of daily diet. But now comes a different era. Move on, if you please, reader, to 1813. In the summer of the year we have just quitted, I have suffered much in bodily health from distress of mind connected with a very melancholy event. This event being no ways related to the subject now before me, further than through the bodily illness which it produced, I need not more particularly notice. Whether this illness of 1812 had any share in that of 1813, I know not. But so it was that in the latter year I was attacked by a most appalling irritation of the stomach, in all respects the same as that which had caused me so much suffering in youth, and accompanied by a revival of all the old dreams. This is the point of my narrative on which, as respects to my own self-justification, the whole of what follows may be said to hinge. And here I find myself in a perplexing dilemma. Either on the one hand I must exhaust the reader's patience by such a detail of my malady or my struggles with it as might suffice to establish the fact of my inability to wrestle any longer with the irritations and constant sufferings, or on the other hand, by passing lightly over the critical part of my story. I must further go the benefit of a stronger impression left on the mind of the reader, and must lay myself open to the misconstructions of having slipped by the easy and gradual steps of self-indulging persons from the first to the final stage of opium eating, a misconstruction to which there will be a lurking predisposition in most readers from my previous acknowledgments. This is the delirium. I want to say that I just finished the hour, and we're now into recorded time, and I'll stop within the next paragraph. And this is the point of my narrative in which we all respect the self-justification. The whole of all that follows may be said to hinge. Here I find myself in a perplexing dilemma. Either on the one hand I must exhaust, I must forego the benefit of a stronger impression left on the mind of the reader, and must lay myself open to the misconstruction having slipped by the easy and gradual steps of self-indulging persons. This is the dilemma, the first horn of which would be sufficient to toss and gore any column of patient readers. Though drawn up 16 deep and constantly relieved by freshmen, consequently that it is not be thought of, it remains then that I postulate so much as is necessary for my purpose. And let me take as full credit for what I postulate as if I had demonstrated it, good reader, at the expense of your patience and my own. Be not so ungenerous as to let me suffer in your good opinion through my own forbearance and regard for your comfort. No, believe that I ask of you that I could resist no longer. Believe it liberally and as an act of grace, or else in mere prudence. For if not, then in the next edition of my Opium Confessions, revised and enlarged, I will make you believe and tremble by mere dint of pendiculation. I will terrify all readers of mine from ever again questioning any postulate that I shall think fit to make. This then, let me repeat. I postulate that at the time I began to take opium daily, I could not have done otherwise. Whether indeed afterwards I might not have succeeded in breaking up the habit, even when it seemed to me that all efforts would be unavailing. And whether many of the innumerable efforts which I did make might not have been carried much further, my gradual reconquest of ground lost might not have been followed up much more energetically. And these are questions which I must decline. Perhaps I might make out a case of palliation, but shall I speak ingenuously? I confess it as a besetting infirmity of mine that I am too much of an eudaimonist. I hanker too much after a state of happiness, both of myself and others. And I cannot face misery, whether my own or not, and am I of sufficient firmness, and am little capable of encountering present pain for the sake of any reversionary benefit. And on some other matters, I can agree with the gentleman in the cotton trade at Manchester in affecting the Stoic philosophy, but not in this. Here I take the liberty of an eclectic philosopher. I look out from some courteous and considerate sect that will condescend more to the infirmed condition of an opium eater than are sweet men, as Chaucer says, to give absolution, and will show some conscience in the penances they inflict and the efforts of abstinence they exact from poor sinners like myself. An inhuman moralist, I can know more endure in my nervous state than opium that has not been boiled. At any rate, he who summons me to send out a large freight of self-denial and mortification upon any cruising voyage of moral improvement must make it clear to my understanding that the concern is a hopeful one. At my time of life, 60 and 30 years of age, 36 years old, it cannot be supposed that I have much energy to spare. In fact, I find it all little enough for the intellectual labors I have on my hands, and therefore let no man expect to frighten me by a few hard words into embarking any part of it upon desperate adventures of morality. And with those words, I'm going to end tonight, and we take it from him. Listen, you know, don't judge me. Don't judge me, he's saying. You know, I've been down and back, and I'm here to tell you, you know, that for the pleasures of opium, there are also the pains of opium. And the pleasures of love, there are pains of love. Pleasures of getting high, there are serious pains for getting loaded. Also comes with addiction. So, join me again tomorrow, next week, when I continue part 5 of this week. And, you'll hear the warnings that he gives, as well as the subtle humor and the tremendous sincerity of this man, you know, in his confession, right? And saying, "You can't change me. I am what I am, but here is what I am. Here is what it does. Here is what it is." And, you know, what can I tell you? But at 36, he lived twice that long. And, whatever floats your boat, right? So with that, I'm going to leave you tonight, and I want to thank you very much for listening. And I would really, really wish to thank you because of the